Do you manage your own IT for distributed teams in Asia? And you know how painful it is. Essavel helps your in-house team by taking cumbersome tasks off their hands and giving them the tools to manage IT effectively. Get help across 8 countries in Asia Pacific, from on and offboarding, procuring devices, to real-time IT support and device management. With our state-of-the-art platform, gain full control of all your IT infrastructure in one place. Our team of IT support pros are keen to help you grow. So check out esevel.com and get a demo today. Use our referral code ASIA for 3 months free. Terms and conditions apply.
The key thing that I realize every time I look at the data is that the media is telling us a lot of nonsense. I think that's the one thing I know, is that the data tells a very different story to the media headlines. So I suppose my advice there is, never accept clickbait at face value. If you're going to be a, you know, if you're building a marketing plan, do your due diligence, check the data, because the data always surprises me. The one thing I know is that I'm always surprised.
Welcome to Analyze Asia, the premier podcast dedicated to dissecting the pulse of business, technology, and media in Asia. I'm Bernard Leung, and before I knew it, Digital 2024 is already here. It feels like I've always have just spoke to Simon Kam, founder and CEO of Capios, and the definitive key man for the annual digital report yesterday. Where are we going in digital 2024? And are we seeing glimpses of generative AI yet in digital advertising and branding? What better way to start off the Q1 2024 with Simon here to talk about the report? And it's our 7th year doing this. And Simon, welcome to the show.
Thank you, sir. Yes. Thanks for having me back. 7 years, that's quite an impressive total.
Yes, I think so. You're probably almost getting to become one of my top recurring guests on the show.
I'm privileged. Thanks, Bernard.
Yes, since our last conversation, what have you been up to?
Producing reports, Bernard. There's nothing to do with my life.
No.
Maybe in the data. Yeah, no, it's been interesting. So we've actually been doing a bit more client work this year, which is unusual. Normally, it's just the reports right the way through, but this year, doing a bit of client work around that as well. But definitely, one of the things we're working on at the moment is changing the way that we produce and deliver the reports. I'm not going to tell you too much about that because it's still a work in progress, but hopefully next year, if you want me back again for 2025, I'll have some stories on how we've changed that. And hopefully, we'll have a lot more stuff to share as well.
I hope you are doing something like the REC for your digital report, which is retrieval augmented generation using AI, and like a chatbot works perfectly if I search for anything.
Here's the really interesting thing. So everybody keeps talking to me about, are you going to be replaced by AI? Is it going to kill the reports? All that kind of stuff. Just before we get into talking about the reports, there's one really important thing, is that the AI needs fresh information in order for it to be relevant. It can't do the work on its own. It needs inputs. And from what I can understand, based on the stats that I see reported in AI tools, the AI tools are using the report for their inputs. So I've still got a job. I don't know about everybody else, but I still need to feed the beast. So I'm feeling like my new master is the AI. I have to feed it.
I don't think AI actually replaces your job. I think AI actually augments your job and helps you to assemble everything properly. Once you can get the data and plus your own insights, that's where AI is. I think but the rumors of AI taking over all our jobs are really exaggerated, right?
Yeah, now at least. Until they kill us all, we're good.
True. So let's go straight to the main subject of the day. I followed your report for the past decade. So what are the 5 most exciting takeaways for digital report in 2024?
So the key headline, the biggest story we reported this year was 5 billion active social media identities. I think that's probably the juiciest story, if you like, because whenever you've got a nice round milestone, people get excited. Whether it was any more interesting than 4.95 billion, I don't know, but 5 billion is a good number. So yeah, that's really important. I think the key takeaway from that is that social media is not dead. I know we're probably going to unpack that based on the kind of stuff that I know you like to talk about, Bernard. We'll dig into that number, but that was the one that really stood out. But I mean, even in just the global overview report, which is just one of 250 that we've published since the start of this year, even just in that report, we've got 560 odd charts. So there's a lot to unpack. The continued growth of social media, so not just the fact that we've got 5 billion, the fact that it's still growing is really important, but there's an awful lot of really interesting nuance. I think choosing anything other than the top number is quite difficult. I mean, I have to produce the top 10 takeaways when we do our launch. I do a video to go with that. And every year it's like, I have about 50 things that I want to include. It's really difficult. So I'll choose one and I'll let you choose some of the other four or 24 things you want to dive into based on what you saw in the report, because otherwise I'll be here all day talking about what I'm interested in, which is not what people want.
The TikTok one is pretty interesting because while we are talking in the recording now, the US Congress had actually put a motion to ban TikTok, as in they forcing them to divest based on what I read as of what is updated. Yeah. I saw the TikTok CEO has responded on that as well. And members of Congress are now getting phone calls for angry influencers in the US asking them not to ban it. So that is probably, if there's a key takeaway in terms of TikTok from your report, before we get into discussing what happened in the US and what's impact be, where is that? What have you seen the most interesting about TikTok this year as a key takeaway?
Growing quickly. That shouldn't come as a surprise, but I think the speed at which it continues to grow certainly still shocks me. I mean, we saw year-on-year growth of almost 25%, which when you consider that it's already passed a billion active users from the advertising reach perspective, so that the numbers that we report in the Global Digital Report series are based on the advertising reach for TikTok. And that figure is based on users aged 18 and above. So it's not even like, it's not counting those younger teenage users. And even then we're seeing, you know, really, really strong. So more than 1.5 billion reach. We've got 25% year-on-year growth. It's just incredible. So it's very, very clear that TikTok in a relatively short period of time has become a critical part of many, many people's lives around the world. And that continues to grow. So the amount of time people are spending on it also increased year on year. We're seeing people spending an average of more than an hour per day using it. We're going to unpack all of these numbers, I'm sure. I know you want to dig into these, Bernard. But you know, those are the key headlines. I think the key bit to take away from that is that TikTok is still gaining momentum. So unless somebody stands in its way, it's definitely going to continue that.
I think I'll move back to where I want to start off the conversation, because I looked at each of your headlines and I have some questions on that. But maybe the first one I want to start is the 5 billion social media users that you identify globally. What are still the primary factors that's driving this unprecedented growth, and how is it impacting in terms of global and marketing strategies moving forward?
Yeah. So I confess, the fact that it's still growing at a relatively quick rate surprises me. I mean, we saw 266 million new users come online during 2023, which if you think about it, it's quite a sizable number. It's not quite as big as the growth that we saw at the peak of COVID. And I think, you know, we unpacked that a few years ago, so we're not going to go back into it. Listeners tuning in for the first time today, if you want to understand it, go back and listen to previous episodes where Bernard and I unpacked that. But the fact that it's still growing relatively quickly, I confess every year I look at it and expect to see almost zero growth, because it's like it cannot continue to grow forever. But, you know, every time I look at the numbers, I'm like, oh, okay, it's still growing faster than I expected. Now, some of that is because people are coming online for the very first time. So roughly 100 million people started using the internet for the first time last year. That's not a huge number when you compare the growth that we saw in the middle of last decade, but still 100 million is pretty decent growth when you consider that we're already approaching 2/3 of the total world population using the internet. Hopefully we're going to reach the 2/3 magical supermajority figure a little bit later this year, but you know, we can never quite predict when these things happen. So yeah, those new people coming online for the first time, one of the first things that they do is use social media. So that's contributed some of that growth. But even then, that would only contribute maybe 30-40% of that overall total. So we are seeing some people starting to use social media for the first time, even if they've been using the internet for other things. I do suspect there's a bit of duplication in there. So that's one of the reasons why we talk about social media user identities rather than unique individuals, because we can't, there's no physical way of separating those numbers out. But nonetheless, I think, you know, my analysis of all the available data does suggest that the 5 billion figure that we've got is probably very close to the actual number of humans that are using social media. So while I put those caveats in, I'm confident that, you know, it's broadly representative of the actual figure in there. So Bernard, that was a long way of saying, I'm not quite sure why we're still seeing growth, but the data is all, it's all confirming that, you know, we're seeing it in multiple different sources.
Could it be also like, because is Asia Pacific still the largest growing region? Because there's still a lot of people that are coming online for the first time, specifically say South India and some other parts of Indonesia.
Yeah. So India is definitely an important factor. I think we could spend an entire hour just talking about the growth of India and the impact that's going to have. So that's one of the key trends I'm looking at this year is the impact that India is going to have on, first of all, digital commercial opportunities, but perhaps more importantly, culture. So digital culture around the world, for a variety of reasons, India is poised to have the biggest impact on digital culture in the months ahead. So let's come back to that later if you want to unpack that. Africa driving a lot of growth as well. But to be honest, we're seeing growth almost everywhere, even in places that were, I thought, were already saturated. We're still seeing those figures inch up. So, yeah.
Maybe it's just the first wave, people having multiple accounts, and then now actually the real population coming in, and then that's probably it. But maybe what implications, I think, in terms of people spending time online, especially like considering now people talk about productivity and also digital well-being. I mean, someone say when they turn on Reliance Jio, turn on their infinite internet access, you know, people spending 24 hours watching YouTube videos and Netflix videos.
Yep. That's what we saw. It was a fascinating. I mean, so India still has one of the highest per capita consumption of mobile data in the world, which is fascinating. I think it's really interesting. When you give people unlimited access, they take advantage of it. So financial concerns aside, I think that one in itself is a fascinating takeaway. We talked this time last year about the fact that the amount of time that people spend online going down. And I think what's interesting is we've actually seen that go back up slightly this year. So it was a minimal increase, less than a percentage point year on year in terms of the amount of time that people are spending. But the reversal of that was the key takeaway. So last year, we were hypothesizing that people were being a bit more purposeful and considered in what they do online. That was my excuse for why the amount of time had gone down. Now that it's going back up again, the question is, well, does that mean that people are being less purposeful? Does that mean that they're perhaps wasting time? And actually, there is something in the data to support that. So the idea that people are filling spare time on the internet is very clear. We're seeing a lot of people, perhaps, you know, the infinite scroll, especially on things like TikTok, people are filling waiting time, shall we say. You know, they're waiting for the bus, they're sitting in a waiting room at the doctor or the dentist. They've got time to kill, and they're scrolling and they're scrolling. Sometimes they're doing it at work. Sometimes they're doing it when they should be doing other things, but we'll assume that they're making good use of dead time here. And that's really important. I think when you look at the average number of reasons that people give for why they use the internet as a whole, the average has gone up year on year. And I think that's really interesting. We're doing more things online. Now, what those more things involve varies by culture. It varies from individual to individual. So there's no catch-all, why did that happen? But I think it's quite clear that perhaps people came out of COVID, they maybe wanted to spend a bit more time away from the internet. But now that things have settled post-COVID, I think we're seeing a return to a lot of those digital behaviors, and people are doing more stuff online again. So we're back to pre-COVID, let's call it that.
Some things do change and some things stay as the same. So I think, yeah. What about things like e-commerce, search engine use? Do you see any changes in the trend lines for those areas?
Search, definitely. Let's come back to search in just a moment. The e-commerce one, I think when I was looking at the data, I always expect to see something really stand out for me. In this year's e-commerce data, there was no massive change in terms of, you know, behaviors or trends or whatever else. There was growth. There's lots of encouraging news in there. But you know, for the purposes of juicy headlines on your podcast, Bernard, I'm afraid there's nothing stand out there. The one thing I will say, though, I mean, despite the fact that we're still seeing strong growth and despite the fact that e-commerce is clearly a massive opportunity, even when you look at everyday consumer goods, you know, things like consumer electronics and beauty and healthcare and all that kind of stuff, still at a worldwide level, we're only seeing $1 in $7 go into online channels. The remaining $6 out of those $7 is still going to offline. So, you know, traditional supermarkets, small stores and whatever. So there is still huge scope for growth within the e-commerce world. And I think one of the things that surprises me is that it isn't growing faster. I think after COVID, I kind of anticipated that people would have developed that habit and we would have seen a bit of a flywheel effect. There's nothing in the data to suggest that's happened. And that, I suppose, is a key takeaway. Contrary to that, though, when you look at search behaviors, those are changing quite interestingly. So a few years back, we talked about voice, and I was getting quite excited and was thinking that that was going to be one of the big drivers of future growth. To be honest, that plateaued. So voice search, much as it's still an important thing, and it's still, you know, 1 in 3 internet users around the world still uses voice on a regular basis to look for information. It didn't continue to grow at the rates that we saw perhaps at the start of COVID especially. But we're seeing things like the rise of social media search. We could probably unpack that a bit more if you want to get into that. Image search is still there, but it's also not growing. But we're seeing people start to use AI tools to inform them. What I want to stress here is that those are not a replacement for search. And I think this is the really frustrating bit. Once again, I mean, we talk a lot, Bernard, in our annual conversations about how frustrated I get about the media and how they misrepresent stories. These are not replacements. These are additions. So I'll pause and I'll let you ask your questions. But yeah, the key takeaway, don't trust the headlines.
Yeah. So then I'm going to go right in to ask a question. You talk about the internet and social media usage. There's a lot of variations, and now with generative AI. And I actually agree with you. I don't think generative AI is a new thing. It's actually, like, if you look at Perplexity, it's search plus generating the content for the query for yes and no. So how do you sort of how should global business thinking about adapting to, say, for example, let's go to the search engine conversation that you were talking about. How do they deep dive into how people are doing searches, and how does these numbers pop out to help them to make informed decisions then?
Yeah. So I think the key takeaway from the data, this is from GWI's ongoing survey. So 53 countries around the world, the audience that they survey represents more than 85% of the world's adult internet users. So incredibly representative. Very clear takeaway in there that search engines are still critical. So more than 90% of users are making use of search engines on a regular basis. That's true right the way across all age groups. But the biggest surprise for me in that data is that the younger users are the biggest users of search engines. I'm sure over the recent months, you've seen a lot of stories about kids are abandoning Google for TikTok. That's nonsense. They're not abandoning it. Yes, they are searching on TikTok, and that's a really important trend, but they're also searching on Google and Bing and other things as well. So do not get distracted by clickbait. It's not true. But yeah, I think the key takeaway here is that we're still relying on search engines, especially when it comes to discovering new brands. So we're seeing search engines are a core driver of learning about new commercial products. When we're researching which brand we want to choose when we're deciding on making a purchase, search engines are still a primary destination, although amongst younger groups, social networks are actually the first place that they will go to look for things. Again, this is an and, not an or. This is not a binary choice. They're doing both. So if you're planning a marketing sort of mix campaign, if you're wanting to understand where search fits, it's just as important as it always has been, but maybe the ways in which you use it need to evolve. So you need to see those Google search behaviors alongside social media search behaviors. People are going to go to video platforms to do a deeper sort of recce of what's going on in the world. So don't see SEO as a standalone activity. It needs to be part of a broader mix. I think, you know, we'll talk a lot about the mix today as we go through things, but I think marketers are losing sight of the fact that a lot of these things work in concert together. They are complementary. And they're not binary choices that you can only do one or the other. That's nonsense. The mix is just as important, if not more important, than it was before.
Does generation differences in online behavior actually change the way how you do digital marketing and content strategies? Let me give you an example, right?
Yeah.
So for example, people like myself, the Gen X, they call it, we prefer the Instagram way, take a nice picture, add a filter. And then when Snapchat came out with stories, we totally found ourselves like, oh, what are we going to do with this? But then I started shadowing my brother-in-law who's younger, you know, the millennials, and then he started doing things like story. He explains how you take a moment and then you try to capture that moment and then put that into a story. And then now recently I started using TikTok for Analyze Asia. Then I realized actually what I'm just conveying a message in this moment instance of time, but but there's a very big generational difference between me and how I thought about it 10, 15 years ago. So I don't know whether this is showing up in your data as such.
It is. Yeah, what people do, how they do it, what their preferences are, all of that is influenced by age. I think when we look at a marketing world, age is misunderstood. So you don't suddenly turn from 44 to 45, you move into a new marketing bracket, and all of a sudden every one of your behaviors changes. It's not how this works at all. And we know that intuitively. And yet, stupidly, as soon as we sit down to start planning our activities, we put everybody into these arbitrary age buckets, and it's a bit nonsense. I think age is an interesting place to start. So when you look at a country like Japan, for example, the fact that the median age of the population is approaching 50, it very clearly has a different set of digital behaviors to a country like Nigeria, where the average age is considerably lower. That's important because people's expectations, their needs, the momentum of the population is in a different place. But at the same time, I think if you look at, you know, my behaviors versus my parents' behaviors versus my niece and nephew, who are obviously a lot younger than me, the way that they do things online is different. Our expectations of what we get back even from the same platform. So what young people expect from Instagram is different from what you and I would expect, Bernard. And I think that bit is important. So rather than just looking at do people use the platform, the data's all there. So within the report, you'll find some of it. If you need to dig deeper, you've got fantastic resources like GWI that allow you to see what people at different age points in their life are doing on each platform and why they're going there. So just to your point there, about the contrast between Instagram and TikTok is really interesting. The data from GWI is telling us that a lot of people go to Instagram to publish their own content. And yet when they're going to TikTok, they're there to consume other people's content. And they're much less likely to publish their own, which I think a lot of marketers will find quite surprising. I think a lot of them see Reels and TikToks as being almost identical in terms of the format. But then when you look at the reasons why the audiences are going there, there's some very distinct differences. And I think, you know, that automatically will change the mindset and the emotional state that you're in when you open that app, what you're hoping to get out of that experience. And that's going to then determine how you respond to marketing. So even something as simple as that is going to change your reaction to what is essentially exactly the same content that marketers are publishing. So use the data every time. I think that's the important bit. Have a hypothesis, but then test it.
That is a very good point, because when I first started doing video, I do YouTube Shorts, TikTok, and TikTok's traffic is, the more people are actually consuming the video in the TikTok traffic, I just basically use Instagram and Reels to just post the content. But I never actually see that engagement. But, you know, now that you even put it up in front of me, I'm like, yeah, actually, that is exactly what is happening. So if that's the case, right, then how should content creators like myself and even yourself and platforms need to adapt then?
Yes, I think the first thing I would recommend is take a deep breath. You don't need to be everywhere all at once. One of the most refreshing takeaways from the report is that on any given platform, you can reach almost 99% of the users on at least one other platform. So trying to be everywhere, once you get past the top two or three platforms, you're going to significantly see diminishing returns. There is simply no benefit to being everywhere. Having said that, being on a couple of different platforms allows you to do a few different things. You will reach more people. Obviously, there's a reach issue there, but critically, you're going to reach people in different settings. So even if I reach the same person, I may reach them at a completely different time of day when they're in a different mindset. So if you think about it, if I reach you in the morning when you're on the commute, you may be still a bit bleary-eyed and sleepy, but you're getting ready for the day. So perhaps a commercial message that sets you up for your work day is really important. Same person at the end of the day when they're sitting in front of the TV, you know, they're binge-watching Netflix, they're scrolling their phone at the same time. They're going to be looking for very different things, and therefore they're going to respond to different messages in different ways. And I think that's the bit that we need to think about. I'm going to go back to my mix message that I talked about earlier, Bernard. So I think you've got to start with the people. Don't start with the channels. Don't start with the technology. Those are simply means to an end. So if you imagine that you're a work person, suppose you're a carpenter and you've got to do some work in a house. In your toolkit, you've got saws, you've got hammers, you've got all sorts of other tools. Choose the right tool for the job. If you're taking a saw and trying to hammer a nail in with it, you're going to be really disappointed. You could probably get somewhere, but there's much better ways of doing things. And I think that's the bit that marketers need to do. We've got to stop getting excited by shiny new toys, take a step back and go, this is the message that I want to deliver to these people. Where are the best times and places in their lives for me to deliver that message, and what channels allow me to do that? Once you've answered those questions, 9 times out of 10, you've already got the answer. It's going to be Snapchat because I want to do this at this time with this person. That kind of stuff, to be honest, we are still terrible at as marketers. We still start with the wrong bits. And as a result, our answers are not as good as they could be.
I agree with you. We're actually trying to squeeze down the channels now rather than trying to go wide. The horizontal approach is actually getting more and more difficult by the day.
Yeah. Fewer, bigger, better, right, Bernard? I think that's the key bit. Don't stretch yourself. Do a couple of things. Do it really well. If you're trying to be big on every platform, you're going to exhaust yourself. So you know, choose the ones that matter most to you, the ones that you feel the greatest affinity for as a creator, and go with it. I mean, I'm still not on TikTok, and I don't think I'm ever going to be, because to be honest, I can't find a way of making portrait-shaped graphs. I could do them landscape. So TikTok isn't the place for me.
Okay, so that comes to TikTok, right? So the FYP hashtag, I think amassed something like 55 trillion views, right? So
trillion.
Explain to me, what factors are contributed most to TikTok's unprecedented engagement and success then?
The relatively short content certainly helps. So the fact that a lot of these videos are still fewer than 15 seconds long, right? You know, that the fact that people will watch them again and again and again, so that certainly inflates the number of views, not artificially, but you know, that's a key component to consider versus a YouTube video, for example, where people tend to only watch them a couple of times at most, right? Whereas a a video that's really interesting on the TikTok feed, you can quite often watch that multiple times, especially if it's music and you want to listen to it again and again. But yeah, I confess, I look at these numbers and I cannot get my head around them. I mean, like, I have to count the zeros. It's like, have I got this number accurate written down? It's just incredible. Like, trillions, once you get into the trillions, it just starts to be a bit sort of like beyond what the human mind can consider. But so we've got a whole chart in the report on the different hashtags in there, and some of them really mess with my head. So I think one of the bits that I was really interested in is the rise of non-English language hashtags. For me, that was a really powerful takeaway, because we don't see that as much on Instagram. There are non-English language hashtags on Instagram that are very popular, especially in places like the Middle East. You see quite a lot of Arabic hashtags, but they don't come through in the top ranked hashtags at a worldwide level. Whereas on TikTok, we're seeing a lot of that, a lot of Spanish hashtags. We're even seeing some Vietnamese language hashtags coming through in there. So that to me tells a really powerful story. I think the global diversity of content, if you like, on TikTok is much stronger because of the fact that it's, because of the way that the algorithm works on there, you're actually seeing a much greater diversity of content reaching the average person. And therefore, people are less concerned about following perhaps the rules that drove how Instagram grew. There's a lot of takeaways in there for marketers. I think we need to be broader in our thinking when it comes to TikTok compared to some of the other channels, because that's what audiences have come to expect. I wouldn't necessarily take those learnings and try them apply to a Facebook, because that's probably not going to work in the same way. So you do need to think, even when it comes to content creation, you need to think differently about these platforms. But yeah, sorry, going back to your question, Bernard, what's driving that? I wish I knew. When I look at some of the things that have come through, so one of the top hashtags is FY followed by 23 Ps. And I've spoken to a few people since we published the report about why this is happening. And everybody just looks at me and says, if you know, you know. And if you don't, then you're too old. And it's like, okay, I'm too old.
Okay, but then as a TikTok content marketer myself, it's actually very interesting how they help you to target to the correct audience. I mean, I compare YouTube Shorts and TikTok, and for all means, my focus is always on YouTube and very less on TikTok. But it seems to have always overachieving the metrics I set for each of the type of information I want to give to my audience. Yeah. There, it seems that the TikTok piece is actually much interesting. I'll give you a good example so it will help you to think about this, right? So one of the highest TikTok for me in Analyze Asia was a very basic question that I asked a private banker on, from a very top-notch private bank, about what is the minimum amount that you need to set up your family office, all right?
Right.
And funny, in YouTube, it hits relatively okay. But in TikTok, it started generating a lot of conversation. And in the conversation, what she was saying is, you need at least 20 million to set up a family office. And everybody started chiming, this is not true. And then people were debating between 50 and 30. Some people say, no, you have to be a billionaire. You have to be 100 million. Otherwise, this is all, you know, not possible. But that entire stretch of conversations was so viral that it just like it's like this weed that you have and it just suddenly grows. And then I was sitting down there and like, what is going on there?
I confess, like, when you look at what has gained success on one platform versus another, there's no logical reason in many cases why it's happened. I think chance plays an incredibly important role.
That's right.
A lot of this stuff. I think we need to accept that. You can improve your chances of success by trying new things. That's certainly true. The more you try, the more likely you are to have success. But at the same time, if you're looking for a strategic guidance from me on this, I just look at it and I'm like, I shake my head. It's happened an awful lot. When I'm going through things like top shows on Netflix, top music on Spotify, all the videos that gain the greatest momentum on YouTube and TikTok, I confess I find myself shaking my head going, what? Even when it comes to what people are searching for on YouTube, I mean, it staggers me that the top searches on YouTube around the world are song and video.
Yeah.
It's like, what did you expect when you went into YouTube? It's a video platform. Why are you searching for video? What are you expecting the answer to be when it gives you the return on this? So,
But so coming back, right? So like, for example, the TikTok users are now spending something like 34 hours per month on the app. So it's already surpassed YouTube in terms of that, right? Does it mean that the way how people do content consumption is very different? That means if you can be able to squeeze like very insightful stuff down to say less than a minute, you can push a lot of your content. Okay, regardless of what you want to do for the call to action, there's a separate question, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So a couple of bits on that. In terms of the average time per user, TikTok is the highest at 34 hours per month. But because YouTube has a greater number of users overall, it actually accounts for the greatest total time spent on platform. Now, I know that's a bit difficult to get your head around, but
yeah.
The figures for average time are just per user. Don't get me wrong, there are well over a billion users on TikTok. So we're still looking at a massively important audience here, but YouTube is still potentially, YouTube numbers are a bit more difficult. Google is very cagey about sharing numbers. So getting accurate figures for YouTube is close to impossible. The figure we report is 2.5 billion monthly active users on YouTube, and that's based on the advertising audience. But my analysis suggests it's probably in excess of 3 billion because the advertising audience only includes logged in users. So I would reckon you're probably looking at roughly YouTube audience being roughly twice the size, maybe 40% larger than TikTok's. But nonetheless, yeah. So TikTok, what you see, the expectation on there, because it's shorter videos, because of the way that the thing works, because of where and when people are when they're consuming TikTok videos, you need to deliver a very different kind of message. It's exactly your experience, Bernard. You know, you were saying, I was surprised that this kind of content worked on TikTok, whereas it did very different performance on YouTube. That's exactly the kind of thing that I think most people tuning in today are going to have. It's, you know, they look at it and they're like, why are these things so different? In my mind, as a marketer, these are videos and therefore they should perform similarly. That for you is the key takeaway here. I think what you realize is that video is not created equal across different platforms. It's the experience. Why was the user there? Why did they open an app? What are they looking for? And on TikTok, they're looking for quick stimulus. They're looking for small takeaways. They're looking for a bit more entertainment than they would be on YouTube, where perhaps they're looking for a bit more information or a longer format video. So they're not video. You've got to take your head completely out of that and say, this is a user experience rather than anything else. That's where you start from. I'm going to repeat that again and again. It's all about the user and what they're expecting, not what we go in to do as a marketer.
Mm. So I'm going to try a very important question on you.
I'm nervous now.
And let's hope, and we're definitely going to clip this into a TikTok video and see how it goes, okay? So what are your thoughts on the current TikTok ban? We talk about very early in the conversation about what just happened to TikTok in the US.
Yeah.
What do you think about the ban? And would it also impact TikTok's performance as a marketing platform across the world? Because the US audience is extremely important. In fact, there is also additional part from the information that actually TikTok doesn't make money. It's Douyin in China, the Chinese equivalent of the app that's printing money, and it's actually subsidizing the entire of TikTok. I don't know what is true or not true, but this is based on their reporting. And I think the information is a pretty trusted source for me. So,
okay. I would be surprised if Douyin's the only one that's making money. I think TikTok's probably doing a pretty good job of making money. Now, is it going to get banned? That's anybody's guess. I think fairly obvious to anybody, especially from the Asian audience tuning in today, this is a political story more than anything else. So I'm not going to stray into the politics. There's also, I look at this kind of stuff and I'm like, to be honest, it's disappointing that we've got to that stage, but you know, whatever. Let's park that bit. If it does get banned, it's going to have a significant impact on marketers everywhere because, like you said, I mean, the US market is still by far the largest marketing market in the world. It's where the biggest share per... Sorry, let me qualify that. The amount spent per user is greatest in the United States compared with anywhere else in the world. So, you know, per capita spend on advertising and marketing is by far the biggest over there. It's crazy, right? But critically also, a lot of marketing decisions are headquartered in the United States. And if it's not part of their to-do list, it slips off the global to-do list in many cases as well. I think a lot of Asian marketers will get very frustrated by the fact that things that matter in this part of the world simply aren't on the radars of people in North America because they've never heard of it. And it just drives us crazy. So when I was working in agencies around Asia, I used to just get the anger. It's like, why don't you understand the biggest audience in the world? You've got no concept of what's going on here. I think that's a real danger for marketers, is that we end up in a more fragmented world. I think the idea that we've got a common language and common reference points is very helpful. Now, the fact that the audiences use those platforms in completely different ways in different countries is still really important. You look at how people in Japan use what used to be called Twitter, is now called X. You look at how Japanese people use that versus how people in the US use that. It's completely different, even though the platform is the same. So yeah, I think that the potential of losing TikTok out the mix from a marketer's perspective is is worrisome. I'm going to caveat that, though. I mean, with all respect to TikTok, and I think it's a fantastic opportunity, more than 99% of the users of TikTok use other platforms. So we're still going to be able to reach exactly the same audiences on other platforms as we did before. We just have to think of different ways of doing that. So our overall reach is not going to decline. The ways that we reach those people and what we share with them is going to need to change. So don't panic. This is a frustration. But yeah, I think, you know, obviously if you work for TikTok, it's a little bit more serious. But I think for the average marketer, this is simply one of the tools and one of the effective tools being taken out of our box. So I'm not panicking. I'm just a little bit disappointed that we've arrived at this point.
It's a bit interesting. And I want to go back to just now the question about the different platforms, right? Because you say people go to TikTok and go to Instagram for very different reasons.
Correct.
Is it going to make, for example, I think you were spot on how Japanese users Twitter, now called X, okay? If you think from, there is X, formerly known as Twitter, versus Threads, and I think the Threads users are slightly different. They're just looking for another place to post. And similarly for TikTok, if you can't do it there, you do it in Instagram or Facebook or, you know, or even YouTube Shorts. Do you see that behavior swap starts to shift? The behavior mix starts to shift then?
A really good sort of reference point here is India. So India, the Indian government banned TikTok a few years back. And as a result, the way that people use different platforms in India is quite different. You're seeing an awful lot of TikTok behaviors on both Instagram and YouTube. Ironically, in India, one of the top search terms on YouTube is TikTok. Go figure, right? It's fascinating. I don't know how I would feel about that as Google, but it's okay. I mean, they're still getting the advertising revenue from that audience. So it's great.
They're so ironic.
Right. But I think people have kind of fallen in love with a couple of things on TikTok. One of them is the short format. So the fact that it's a little bit, remember back in our youth, Bernard, when we were kids, we spent a lot of time surfing TV channels. You know, you'd have the remote control and you'd be like, change the channel, change the channel, change the channel. Because you just wanted stimulus. You wanted a variety of stimulus. TikTok does that incredibly well. You know, you're scrolling, it's changing fast, all that kind of stuff. That desire, if you like, from a user's perspective, is not going anywhere. It's still part of daily life, and TikTok satisfies it. If you can't do it on TikTok, you're going to go elsewhere to find that kind of thing. And I think, you know, YouTube Shorts, Instagram Reels, you'll see a lot of that stuff. If TikTok does get banned in the US, you'll just see those behaviors quickly move over. The creators that won't have anywhere to publish anymore, they're going to jump ship very quickly to other platforms because that's their livelihood. They need to take their audiences somewhere. So yeah, I think looking at why people are falling, you know, why people are spending so much time on TikTok, there's a very clear benefit that they are perceiving in there. And they want that satisfied. So the behaviors will simply move to other platforms. Sorry, TikTok. I don't mean to say you're replaceable, but you know, people have needs and they'll move.
Okay. I'm gonna go two more platforms before I get into the generative AI piece. So first I want to talk about Discord, because I think you and I like to talk about messaging apps, because I think that's the most untold story in social media to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
So Discord had a pretty significant user base growth that I've seen from your data this year. Can you share some insights like how this kind of niche platforms are beginning to actually expanding their appeal to broader audience? You can say the same for, say, something like Telegram as well. You can also say the same for, I think WeChat is just China bound. And for anyone from China who wants to communicate to the outside world, it's the only funnel.
So let's start with WeChat because it's an easy one. WeChat's still growing. It's still an incredibly important platform, but well over 80%, probably 85% of the platform's users are based in mainland China. And if you look at the affinity that people feel for WeChat, it's only really mainland Chinese users that have any affinity for it. People outside China are only using WeChat really to communicate with people in China or to communicate with other Chinese nationals. So WeChat is incredibly important in the mix if China's part of your world. If China isn't part of your world, then to be honest, you can probably take it off your list.
That's right.
Discord is amazing. I mean, Discord and Telegram both fascinate me. So even since we published the report just a few weeks ago, Telegram's recently announced another impressive user milestone. It's well on track to being the next billion user platform. And I think that is testament to the distinctive benefit that the communities that it it garners. It's amazing. But Discord is the one that fascinates me. There's two reasons why Discord continues to grow. The first of them is obviously it's got very rich communities built around shared passions. That's where Discord started, and that's why it's grown to be what it is today. But the key second bit of it is the fact that you can access a number of generative AI tools through a Discord server. That has been a really important part. When you look at the biggest servers on Discord, so for those who are not familiar with Discord, a server is a community. It's a forum, a message board, whatever you want to call it. It's the group, if you like. So the biggest servers on Discord are AI tools. So the likes of Midjourney and whatever else, a big driver. But do not be distracted. That's not the only reason people are going. It's not just to create stuff. It's to talk about stuff. It's to get inspiration. It's to get insights. It's to learn how to do things. And I think calling it niche is a really interesting one. Is it niche when it's, let me just caveat this. The company itself, so Discord on its own website suggests that it has about 150 million monthly active users, but my analysis suggests it's probably double that. I don't know why they're being cagey, but the numbers I'm seeing suggest it's probably much closer to 300 million monthly actives. When you get to that sort of size, that's not really niche anymore. With no disrespect to you, Bernard, for calling it that, but you know, 300 million is, if I had 300 million visitors to my website, I'd be popping the champagne right now. That's incredible, right?
I don't have a choice, yeah. You know, is how Wall Street calls it, you know, and now for them, anything as a billion is considered a big, and then anything below a billion is called niche.
Okay, you make a really important point here, Bernard. Marketers, do not reference Wall Street when making your choices, because it's got nothing to do with you. The way Wall Street makes decisions related to social media companies blows my mind. I look at the stats, I look at the trends, and I'm like, why on earth have you got this back to front?
That's right. I absolutely agree with you, which is why I like to have you on the show, because when I think 150 million is a big number, but people still consider it niche. Yeah. I have a theory on why it's 300 and it's below 150 now. It's because there was the crypto winter. And I noticed this across all the community groups that actually it slowed down for a while and now it's suddenly climbing back up.
Yeah. So I think let's qualify this. The 150 million official figure has been on their website for a couple of years. It may just be that they've forgotten to update it, although I doubt it. It may also be that they are planning some kind of IP or whatever else. They need to be very cautious about how they talk about active users, because it is obviously a critical metric. But yeah, so I think the crypto stuff on Discord is important. I would suggest perhaps that crypto on Telegram is even more important. And that, I would guess, is maybe a driver of some of the growth that we're seeing. I mean, the crypto bros and their love of Telegram, there's no secret there. Although I would also hasten to add that Telegram is much more than just crypto. But when you look at the demographics of these two platforms, it is still skewed towards male users. So do be conscious of that. If you're planning a mix, then you know, women do use it, don't get me wrong, and people of non-binary genders as well. But just be careful that there is a skew towards the male audience when it comes to both Discord and to Telegram. Just while we're on this, Bernard, let's unpack a little bit about the investor world and how they treat social media, because it's broken. When I look at the metrics that they're emphasizing, you know, they always talk about the importance of the outlook for advertiser spend and how that's related to user growth. When I look at the actual user numbers, and in particular, the figures that we report are advertising audience numbers, surely that should be the key driver of current sentiment about an advertising driven. So Facebook, Meta as a company, is still 99% dependent on advertising revenues for all of its revenues, right? And yet, it seems that the investor world is not paying enough attention to the trends within the advertising audience. Now, I'm not going to get myself into investment advice. I am not an investment professional. Mm. I cannot give that kind of advice. But I do kind of feel that people are looking at all the wrong metrics and making very, very odd decisions based on the data that I see. If anybody wants to have a private chat, give me a wave. I'm very happy to share the data and tell you why, but let's not do it publicly. But going back to your point there about the communities, as a marketer, yeah, I mean, the passion that we see in communities on Discord is unparalleled. This is an opportunity unlike any other, although that's not quite true. Reddit also is a place where this kind of stuff happens. Communities have long been an under-tapped, under-appreciated opportunity in the marketing world. They're intimidating, and we need to spend a lot of time as marketers getting to know them. But if you can get your head around it, the opportunities are huge. And even if it's just going in to learn about stuff, so you don't need to necessarily even post on these platforms, you can learn about what matters to people in these places. So do that. I mean, if you're looking for insights, fantastic place to go and learn about what people care about and what matters to them. So yeah, add them to your mix. Nice and simple.
Okay, I'm going to talk about a social network that is probably on everyone's radar, but I think it's not always featured prominently, and that's LinkedIn. Mm. So yeah. LinkedIn, I think, recently hit that major milestone of 1 billion registered members. Before Microsoft's acquisition, it was my favorite social network. So I actually like it a lot.
Ooh, I love it. Okay.
I'm actually quite interested to know, like, how do you now interpret some discrepancies that's going on registered, actively engaged users on professional networks like LinkedIn? I think, just to be fair, if I think about, say, business-to-business or B2B sales, for example, LinkedIn is an extremely useful platform. It may not give you the best CTRs, but I think it's the only legitimate one that at least there is some level of measurement. Well, let's say if I were to go to, say, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, or whichever, I don't think I have a better engagement way of thinking about B2B sales. So what are your thoughts on that?
So lots of unpacking there. Let's start at the end of your question there and come back to it. So I think, you know, LinkedIn, when you come to B2B, you'd be crazy not to be considering it. But actually, in a lot of the data, for B2B sales cycles, YouTube is critically important. I'm not suggesting it's more important than LinkedIn, but I think a lot of people are surprised. When you ask people the sources that they turn to when they're looking for information about purchases for the businesses they work for, YouTube comes out incredibly strongly. So don't underestimate. I think the one thing I would suggest is when you're measuring the performance of B2B, you want a very different set of metrics. I think the engagement that consumer packaged goods companies would look at is far, far less relevant in a B2B world. As a B2B marketer, I'm not going to click like and share and whatever else. I'm going to be doing research at work. My behaviors are very different. So totally different set of metrics. I mean, even for consumer goods, I would reckon that engagement has lost its meaning. It's just a nonsense number that we're addicted to and yet has zero commercial value. But that's a story for another day. So yeah, I think when you're building a B2B mix, do not discount platforms like YouTube and even Instagram. They're still just as relevant because those are the places that a lot of B2B influencers and decision makers are familiar with. Younger folks are a key part of the research process, and they are going to be turning to those platforms to learn about a lot of stuff in a B2B world as well. So try not to get hung up on this idea that it's a consumer platform. It's not. So that one aside. Let's come back to LinkedIn. So the difference between the registered members versus the active users, the reason why LinkedIn publishes total registered members is because a lot of users of LinkedIn only really turn to the platform sporadically. So when they need a job, when they need to learn about somebody that they need to speak to at a meeting or whatever else. But having said that, because of the way that the digital ecosystem works, LinkedIn can still serve advertising to them on other sites. So even if you're not on LinkedIn, if you're not using the LinkedIn app, LinkedIn can still serve you marketing that has been bought through its platform. So while I'm a little bit frustrated that they don't publish monthly active users, I think that it's legitimate to share the total registered members as well. So we've got more than 1 billion registered members on LinkedIn around the world. I'm going to go back to my analysis of the available data. So this is very similar to the Discord stuff that I shared earlier. My analysis, which is not perfect, I'll be totally upfront about that. There's no perfect way to know this number. But looking at the available data, I'd reckon there's between 300 and 350 million users making active use of LinkedIn on a monthly basis. That's not perhaps quite as high as the billion figure suggests, but that's still, again, a very juicy number. And when you think about who those users are and what they're doing when they're on LinkedIn, you realize that that's an incredibly valuable audience. And then you can reach the remaining 600-700 million non-active users via LinkedIn ads on other platforms as well. So yeah, I think if you're not looking at it as an opportunity in the mix, then certainly add it on. That doesn't mean you have to do it. I'll go back to my advice from earlier. Fewer, bigger, better when it comes to your mix is probably the right choice. But nonetheless, don't discount LinkedIn just because you might think of it as a B2B platform. One of the things I'm seeing quite a lot of recently is luxury fashion companies making a lot of use of LinkedIn. That's a really interesting choice, right? I think you can understand logically where that's come from, but I think it's perfectly reasonable to expect that we might start to see other categories. So automobiles, they've been there for a while. Luxury accessories have been there for a while. I see no reason why we shouldn't start to see other consumer categories making better use of LinkedIn. And then B2B, it's a no-brainer. You'd be foolish not to be considering it.
Just before generative AI, what's the one thing you know about digital report in 2024 that very few do.
The key thing that I realize every time I look at the data is that the media is telling us a lot of nonsense. I think that's the one thing I know, is that the data tells a very different story to the media headlines. So I suppose my advice there is never accept clickbait at face value. If you're going to be a, you know, if you're building a marketing plan, do your due diligence, check the data, because the data always surprises me. The one thing I know is that I'm always surprised. There's your key takeaway.
Okay, got it. That's a fantastic takeaway. Let's see whether the TikTok traffic will grow this time around. Okay. Now, okay, main subject. Given the headlines from generative AI in the last year, I mean, it's really growing week by week, because literally every other week I'm seeing a new thing springing up. I'm quite surprised by you did not talk about ChatGPT usage. I don't know whether the information is available to you, and that I have to be very fair to you, or any information specific to that part of the sector. Question is, have you seen any significant usage shifts due to ChatGPT, Midjourney, or Runway? The reason why I use two-three is text, audio, and video, because that actually gives you some indication showing up in your data.
So a couple of things. I think we saw significant growth in traffic to the websites of these platforms at the start of last year. And then during the middle of the year, sort of around about June, July time, we noticed a significant decline in web traffic. Now, there are two things that drove that. And this is where it starts to get fascinating. One of them was the fact that students were on holiday. Students are a big, big user of these tools, at least last year. Things have evolved a lot in the past 12 months, but that was a critical driver. But the thing that a lot of the analysis missed is that platforms like ChatGPT launched their mobile app, and we've seen significant growth in the use of those as well. A lot of people transferred their behavior from web browsers into the app, understandably so. And I think these are the things that we've got to keep our eye on. Why did I not include it in the report? Everybody keeps challenging me on this as though somehow I need to have... This is a free report, Bern, for goodness sake. Everybody expects everything in there for free. Like, if you need,
you think you're the definitive authority on this, you see.
You pay somebody to do it. I looked at a lot of this data. I'm a little bit torn here. I think, you know, ChatGPT, Claude, Midjourney, DALL-E, you name it, all of these tools are fantastic, but they're individual commercial companies. And at the moment, they've not quite reached the same marketing scale, if you like. So you can't deliver marketing messages within these platforms. And if you think about the rest of the report, the majority of it is tailored towards how do I, as a marketer, understand where my audiences are and deliver messages to them. That's kind of what it exists for. Sure enough, there's more in there to find as well, but that's kind of the start point of it. At the moment, things like generative AI are much more of a tool that we use to get us to the kinds of content that we want to create, to inform documents that we need to write, to do a little bit of research and whatever else. I kind of feel like AI at the moment is a little bit more like the internet. You know, it's a lot of different things amalgamated under the same term. And as a result, trying to separate out trends within that is incredibly difficult. Even if I wanted to, you know, so I have through tools like SimilarWeb and SEMrush, I have access to, those are report partners, by the way. I have access to traffic to individual websites, but it's exceptionally difficult for me to deduplicate that. So I cannot easily identify whether somebody who's using ChatGPT is also using Claude, is also using Gemini, is also using X, Y, and Z, right? Yeah. And from that perspective, I can't give you an accurate number on the number of people that are using generative AI in totality. And then I start to get into situations where I include one platform and not another, and people get upset. So it's easier not to report than it is to try and break things down. There's no question it's growing. It's certainly growing in importance, even if the growth in the number of users is not quite as dramatic as perhaps it was this time last year. But from that perspective, I think as a marketer, this goes back to the same sort of story we would see in the social media world. Stop getting distracted by shiny new toys. Why are you excited by it? What's the opportunity that you're chasing here? And what do you think you want to do with it in order to create new value? In most cases, the opportunity within Gen AI is creating content, right? It's generative AI, it's generating things. You can use that to create social media content. You can use it to inform your SEO. This is an input into a lot of your other marketing strategy. If you're not using it, you're missing a trick. You'd be crazy not to be using this. I mean, I'm using it every day, but I'm using it to help me write code for the data report or website. I'm using it to help me understand why a certain trend exists. So for example, when I was doing the preparation for the Digital 2024 report, I asked Claude AI, one of my preferred choices, I asked it why voice search hasn't continued to grow. And it gave me some really interesting suggestions, which I could then go away and validate with data. It didn't tell me the answer. It gave me better questions. And I think, you know, that's my suggestion to anybody who's wondering how they make better use of AI. Don't look at it for answers. Look at it to get you to better questions that you can then use your skills and your knowledge to answer with real value. But yeah, I think just because it's not in the report doesn't mean that I'm not tracking it and doesn't mean it's not important. It's just that I don't have valuable data points to share at this point. But don't misunderstand that. It should be on your to-do list this year. Absolutely.
So given that I'm actually doing a lot of executive masterclasses for generative AI for senior executives in companies, second gen CEOs, and also to even government institutions, one of the things I felt that there is a lot of platforms out there, it's very hard for even them to know which one to use at what point in time. Like, I give you a very good example, right? So like Perplexity, would you put it in a search engine traffic? Because to me, it's still a search engine. I don't think that the media thinks it's a search engine, right? To me, it's just a search query. You type in a query, it goes out to pick out what is the relevant information, and then it adds its own spin to writing that information and present it in the shortest, concise manner to you. But it itself, to me, is still a search engine. And I find it, when people tell me, you know, this is a new paradigm, like, it doesn't sound different from me. It's just like the way you say it, right? It's like the media headlines are all wrong because it's not the way you see it as how you should be using it. Am I right to say this or am I?
Well, yes, but I think that there are also different interpretations of it. So I think this is not an either or, it's a yes and thing again.
Yeah,
it's always the case in digital, right? I think what's really important here, that there's two sides to this. There's the user need and behavior, and then there's the technology that powers it. I think the people that are telling you that this is a new paradigm, they're absolutely correct in saying that the way that it's sourcing this information, the way that it's repackaging it is very different to the way that Google search works. But the way you use it as a user may be incredibly similar to how you use Google, and the needs that you are trying to satisfy with it are probably very similar. Now, I'm not going to suggest that this is a replacement for, we talked about this earlier today, so I'm going to repeat that. This is an and, you know, you're increasing the portfolio of activities that you use in order to find the information that matters to you. I think when it comes to generating content, this is a new paradigm. I think when I look at things like Sora, when I look at Runway, when I look at all of these different things, I am blown away. I don't think we are anywhere near realizing the potential that these tools have yet. A lot of it is like, it's still kind of, you know, there's proof of concept and we're seeing these demos coming out of the companies and everybody's going, oh, isn't this amazing? But we're still seeing the same three videos again and again and again, right? It's like recycling of stuff because we're going through, so back in school, when you were in chemistry class and you were learning about the three, well, physics, chemistry, this is how bad my science is, changes of state, you know, you go from solid to liquid to gas. And as you change the temperature, there's this point in time where you have a changing of state where the energy doesn't change the temperature because it's going through a change of state. It's a really bad analogy because it's quite complicated, but that's kind of, I feel, where we are at the moment in the AI world, is we're adding a huge amount of energy and we're not really seeing a change in temperature because we're seeing a change of state, right? And what I expect to see 2-3 years from now is this sudden explosion of new ways of doing things. Cast your mind back to the mid-90s, for those of you who are alive and conscious at that time. I still remember when the internet started to become a thing and we would see marketing in the mid-90s was, let's create a flyer, like the sort of thing you see people handing out on the street. Let's create a flyer and that's our website. But not even before banner ads, it was just a flyer.
Yeah.
Like, here's the thing that I want to hand you on the street when you're walking down sort of, you know, your main shopping streets. That was interesting, but it didn't really solve a problem. It was just replicating something in a new environment. And then all of a sudden you look at 20, 30 years later, you look at what marketing on the internet is now, and it's a completely different discipline. Right, we still get some companies producing flyers for the internet, but you look at those immersive UIs and all this kind of stuff. It's amazing. I kind of feel like at the moment what we're doing with Gen AI is just replicating what we've already got. That's interesting, but that's not the opportunity. When you start to think about how the world's best movie producers are going to use Gen AI to create completely different storytelling experiences, when you look at how game developers are going to use it, when you look at the world's best creators, when you look at how they're going to use these tools to create new worlds and new experiences, that's when magic is going to happen. And a lot of that takes time. You know, If you think about how long the average movie takes to make, sure enough, that's going to come down with AI, but you still need to make sure that the story is as good as it could be. So don't get distracted by what you're seeing at the moment. I feel a little bit frustrated. You know, people say to me, AI has changed the world. I'm like, not quite. Gen AI is going to change the world. But at the moment, I kind of feel it's a little bit stuck in repeating stuff we've seen before. That will change this year. It will change next year. But the potential is not even 1% of what we're seeing so far.
As someone with a PhD in theoretical physics, I like your analogy of the phase change. It's a phase transition. You're right. Your analogy is perfectly spot on the point.
I don't have a PhD in physics, which is why I explained it so badly.
I'll explain this a little bit more interesting. Just one final question I have. Given that we talk about content generation, right? I think Amazon, Google, Facebook, they have started implementing certain generative AI in different segments of their advertising business. Like Amazon can now do product outlines and product placements. Very good with the copywriting and tell you how to make it better. Similar with Google can do copywriting. I think they added into, if you have enterprise for Google, you run their duet, you can do a lot of other things, the summary of notes, etc. And then Facebook also adding responses to their chatbot. And I think they want to roll out more towards the responsive and the way how they generate stuff. It is really going towards the advertising side. And I'm not even talking about like using AI to optimize your ad buy and spending. That's another world by itself, right?
Completely different world, yeah.
Yeah. How would you, in your perspective, how do you think generative AI would change the dynamics of advertising and branding then?
We're going to go in two different directions, I think, Bernard. And this is a really, really important topic that I don't think the industry is talking about accurately. So in one direction, so I'm going to use somebody else's quote here. This is from the head geographer at Google, ironically, somebody that's not necessarily in the marketing world. But sorry, I forgot the chap's name, but he posted a thing on LinkedIn the other day, which was a joke. He's like, an AI walks into a bar. And the barman says, what are you having? And the AI responds, what everybody else is having. And if you think about it, I mean, it's beautiful because it's exactly what AI does. It takes an analysis of everything that the world has done before, and it summarizes it and it repeats it back, sometimes in slightly different ways, but it is entirely dependent on things that have come before it. And the great irony is that creativity is about creating something new. Now, admittedly, that you know, there's all arguments about whether anything is genuinely ever new, and it's always a recombinance of things that existed already. An AI could do that. But creativity is about understanding a better way of doing something that came before. And at the moment, I think one of the restrictions that we see with AI as it exists today is that it can't do that for us. We as the user still need to tell it what we want, and we need to then take what we're getting from AI and apply it in new ways. That's great. I mean, it's shortcutting an awful lot of the grunt work, and it's giving us new ideas that we would never have had otherwise. So don't get me wrong, there's incredible value in there. But it goes back to that I'll have what everybody else is having statement. Marketing's job, or one of marketing's primary tasks, is to create distinctiveness. And if what we're doing is simply replicating what's come before, we're not going to create distinctiveness. You can create marketing a lot more cheaply with AI, but if it's just the same as everybody else is doing, marketing becomes pointless. You're just making noise. And that noise is not going to cut through, and it's not going to deliver the value that you need. So be very, very careful of using Gen AI to just produce what everybody else is doing. You know, marketers have this tendency of copying what other people do. That's pointless, because your whole job is to create something unique and distinctive. Don't do that. It's not the best use of your budget. I appreciate it's difficult, but do something different, do something new. The good news is that Gen AI allows us to bring our ideas to life once we have a creative idea. So never before have we had a set of tools that allow us to bring what's in our heads and in our hearts alive so quickly and so efficiently. Now, I'm looking at some of the stuff that creators out there are doing with these tools, and I'm blown away. It's like, you know, they had this idea in their head and they create it within a matter of minutes, and it's available for the world to consume. From a storyteller's perspective, that's amazing. Marketing is storytelling. That's one of those great cliches. That's exactly what we want to do. You as the marketer, your job is still to create a strategy that delivers a message to an audience. You've still got to work on that. That's still dependent on you. From that perspective, your job is safe. But how you then bring that message to life, you've now got a whole suite of new tools that didn't exist before that allow you to do that. But you've still got to use them creatively. The tool will not do the job for you. You've still got to do it. The hammer in the toolbox isn't going to hammer in the nail. You've still got to take it and bash it. It's exactly the same for these tools in marketing. So yeah, I mean, when you look at what the platforms are using this for, when you look at what the world's best content creators are using these tools for, take your inspiration from that. But remember, your job remains the same. Engage an audience with something that matters to them in the best possible way.
This is a very good place to almost stop. Last question. What would you have hoped to add to the Digital 2024 report? And I think, what do you look forward in the next conversation, which is a lucky number for the Chinese, which is 8, in 2025?
Okay. I like the fact that you're already planning a year ahead, Bernard. That's great.
Yeah, it's so fast. It's so fast. I just, like,
we'll be here before we know it.
I need a cross timer now. Yeah.
Terrifying. I think I would like to include more analysis. I find myself spending more and more time collecting more data. I think my ambition is to add a little bit more perspective to the numbers. The numbers are brilliant. The numbers are really valuable, but making sense of them is what we need a bit more of. So hopefully by this time next year, Bernard, I'll have a bit more opportunity to add more analysis of the numbers and more numbers as well. Hopefully a bit more AI as well. Hopefully we'll find a way of including numbers that give you a perspective on the directions that we're heading in there. But to be honest, 560 pages in that one report, that's already probably enough. Oh, and by the way, very, very unsubtle plug here, but we do already have all of the individual country reports as well. So 230 plus local country reports with the latest data available on datareportal.com. So to be honest, most of the things I wanted to include, 99% of what I wanted is already in there, and you'll find it for free on Data Reportal. Thank you for the opportunity for the plug, Bernard. That was great.
So many thanks for the conversation. I think this year we have some really good key highlights to talk about.
Yeah,
in closing, two quick questions. Any recommendations that have recently inspired you?
So I'm going to give you a book. Last year, I failed miserably on giving you books. But if you're a marketer tuning in today, the Ehrenberg Bass stuff should already be on your radar. If it's not, add it. So books like the How Brands Grow by Byron Sharp, that's already well over a decade old. But Jenny Romaniuk, I think I pronounced that correctly. She's published a couple of books over the past couple of years all around category entry points and making sense of good marketing. That has been a massive influence on a lot of my thinking over the past few weeks. So as a marketer, all of that stuff, go and dig it out. Jenny Romaniuk is the one you're looking for. Other than that, I would recommend stay curious. Don't read all the same things that everybody else is. Go out, look around the internet, find stuff that's new and innovative and surprise yourself.
And where can my audience find you?
I'm still on LinkedIn, Bernard. I'm still an old man. You won't find me on TikTok. LinkedIn, Simon Kemp. Come and say hello. Give me a wave. Say you came from the podcast and then I'll know who you are. And yeah, we can have a chat there as well.
Definitely, you can find this podcast now in YouTube, TikTok, and everywhere else. And of course, sign up for our newsletter. Every week, we will make our recommendations as such. And Simon, you are always a great friend. So we will continue to talk about this next year and share notes as well.
Look forward. Thank you.